Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices. I am freelance media journalist Chris Sutcliffe.
And I am Peter Houston.
No Esther this week, unfortunately, but you will be able to see all three of us in person this week at 2020 Publishing, an event based in London, of which you can find out more information by going to 2020publishing.co.uk, which is a very solid URL for that event.
Nice.
Yeah. But Peter, who did you talk to this week?
This week I spoke to Digital Content Next Chief Executive, Jason Kent. We spoke about the aims and ambitions of the Trade Association, formerly known as the Online Publishers Association. And you just know we spoke about the duopoly.
But as ever, we begin with the news roundup. And the New York Times' Mark Thompson has been speaking about what lesser mortals can learn from his success. So we talk about the NYT almost as this kind of shining beacon of what can be done if you understand what your audience wants and you have enough of an infrastructure in place to make subscriptions work. But what else in this article can people who don't necessarily have those advantages take away?
I think this was an interesting one because we had spoken about this. I don't know if it was last week or the week before. And we talked about, we love the fact that the failing New York Times is not failing, nowhere near failing. But we did acknowledge that it only really matters if, publishing's lesser mortals can learn from it. And as if Ken Doctor had actually been listening to the Media Voices podcast, he's gone and asked the New York Times chief exec to share his thoughts. Actually, interestingly, given Karen Cross, how local news can be made more sustainable.
But yeah, it's interesting how far down the interview that bit actually comes. And he's talking more about their experience with the Boston Globe, which he apparently fought for. You know, he says within the interview, if the Boston Globe wouldn't work as a Metro title, what was a couple of years ago when it was under the kind of the aegis of the New York Times, then what hope is there for the other Metro titles and other
hope? The Brighton Argus.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
But the reason it's buried so late in the interview is because he actually says, "Yeah, great. That's like a really easy question." Not. You know, he's pretty straight up in saying that he doesn't know. But I think what he does say is interesting. He says, well, there's two things really that he focuses in on. One is, if you produce journalism of value, then you can expect people to pay for it. And he says, it's not about trying to invent a willingness to get people to pay for stuff. It's trying to recapture an existing or an old-fashioned willingness to pay for it.
Yeah. He's talking about that lesson at the NYT, what with all the investment that they're putting into it in terms of journalism and actually investing in, you know, these long form investigations.
Yeah. The context where he's coming from is they've added journalists where other people are cutting journalists. And he's interesting the way he talks about it. He says, don't expect a straight line attribution, you know, in terms of, oh, we added five journalists, we got two-thirds more revenue or whatever. He says it's an investment. But it's an old-fashioned model, which I thought was good. Simple, old-fashioned model, which is exactly why I'm in publishing. Simple and old-fashioned. And he talks about driving new subscriptions through these original investigative stories. They've invested in a gender editor, which means they've got more women readers, so they've grown that part of their market. And the idea that they're not micro-targeting content. You know, it's actually about having faith in the newsroom to put out stuff that people want to read.
Yeah.
But I think what, in dodging the question, which we, you know, let's face it, if someone said to you,
save local journalism in one fell swoop, yeah.
Well, how would you save local journalism? You'd dodge a question.
Yeah.
But I think what was interesting, what you said was, it's about trying to figure out, and this relates back to the Boston Globe point, he's trying to figure out where you can stand and fight. Mm. What have you got that's worth defending? And then can you build on it from there? And I think that's interesting because I don't think he talks about digital advertising and digital advertising about being about a play about, you know, what we've talked about so much is about digital advertising is all about reach and you just can't compete there. Whereas subscriptions are about depth and you can compete there. And what's really happened to local journalism, thinking particularly of Johnson Press, God bless them, and the online stuff, is that they abandoned depth in favour of reach.
Yeah. Do we know any companies that may have made that explicit in a name change?
I was just thinking there's actually someone who's gone all in on that.
Yeah.
But so that idea of reach is not something you can stand and fight. He talks about digital advertising always being the benefit, always will go to the platforms. So that idea of where can you stand and fight, what can you defend, real, honest to God, valuable content that people can pay for. And locally, I saw something the other day on one of these sites about a local newspaper that had gone really heavily on weather content.
What?
Weather. And it was really, really growing their subscriptions because people, I don't know, maybe it's in a place that's got particularly interesting weather or complicated weather, but people were paying to get the weather. And
is it right in the, you know, the path of hurricanes every year, or what's going on?
I don't know. Maybe it was like, where was the Wizard of Oz shot? Kansas? Maybe it's like,
yeah,
Kansas,
we're not in Kansas anymore. Something. That weather idea really speaks to this concept of service journalism, which is what a lot of US titles are going for. There's some other stuff in there just before we move on, though. There's that great quote, if you're producing journalism of value, there is no reason to expect that consumers wouldn't be prepared in some way to support that, potentially to pay for it. And that put me in mind of a lot of what's happening with UK hyperlocals and, you know, kind of the public supported ones or the co-ops. So if you look at what's happened with the Bristol Cable or the Overtake, for instance, where they're saying we are doing those long form in-depth investigations and hopefully people will and are paying for it. So yeah. I think that almost is proof point on a very different scale that actually works even for local publications.
Good news story.
Yeah. Moving on. French media companies team up on a unified login to scale against the Triopoly. So, Peter, what's this about?
A bunch of French publishers, I think 10,
mm-hmm.
have got together. They reckon that between them, they can reach 80% of the French population.
Yeah, I believe that.
That's
10.
Mental. So these French publishers. And what they're trying to do is create a unified login. So if you log into one of these publishers, you're logged in everywhere. So theoretically, if everyone that read these publications was part of this scheme, 80% of the French population would be on the same platform, signed in,
mm-hmm.
And which gives them a scale, theoretically, to take on Google and Amazon and Facebook in terms of these, you know, that kind of sign-in aspect of using one sign-in for Google to be involved, to be signed into a bunch of other sites.
Yeah. So from what you read of this, then, is this an attempt to, you know, as you mentioned, create scale then that can compete with the Triopoly there? Or is this about reducing friction for sign up, which is going to be, you know, as more people push into subscriptions, single sign on seems to be one of the grounds on which publishers will be fighting against the Triopoly.
I think these guys probably see it as a scale play.
Interesting.
But I think what's more interesting is the reduction of friction.
Mm.
Because, you know, we keep going, you know, this whole idea of subscription burnout, the idea that, oh, I've got 5 subscriptions, I can only have 4, who's going to get binned? And if you start having these kind of, you know, the Apple News thing that we talked about last week, you've got one subscription and it lets you a whole sort of portfolio of content for one price. That is absolutely possible with this kind of technology.
Yeah, and they're not the only ones who are doing it. You know, I've seen similar examples in Germany, and then it's like, I think it's Noneo in Portugal, with the explicit aim of doing exactly that, of having this single onboarding and login process.
Yeah. Which... I just wonder how much having a distinct kind of local language like French or Portuguese or German plays a part in that.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, and I'm actually writing an article at the moment on exactly that. It's a really interesting question.
I don't know. I used to always ask that question about The Correspondent.
Mm.
You know, did it succeed because it was in Dutch? And now we'll find out whether... Well, actually, I suppose we found out the first part of that because they crowdfunded successfully in English.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's a time if you'd asked me a year ago, did this have a cat's chance in hell? I probably would have said no. But given the pressure now that, or the heat that Facebook and even Google is taking for all sorts of reasons, I don't know. I think maybe.
And then this next article on the news agenda is just, it's almost a collection of everything that's going wrong with platforms' attempts to manage misinformation and harmful mm-hmm. content. So Pinterest is actually starting to tackle misinformation.
Well, they've effectively broken their own search engine. So Facebook, I guess it was a senator in the States, looked up anti-vaccination propaganda on Facebook and was appalled at what he found.
Yeah.
You know, that the algorithm is basically referring him to all this misinformation about how bad vaccination is for you or for your kids.
It's basically ground zero for that kind of misinformation.
Yeah, and he went nuts, as you, any right-minded legislator would. And Pinterest has actually done something about it, rolled up their perfectly styled and inspired sleeves and stylishly broken their search engine. So what the woman, I can't remember her name, that's terrible. The woman that comments on this on behalf of Pinterest has said, you know, people come here to find inspiration. There's nothing inspiring about harmful content. So they know that this content, they haven't been able to remove the content. They don't know where it all is. So they know that, they've admitted that, and they've just basically broken their search engine so that you can't find, if you search for anti-vax information, you don't get anything. It's just a big blank page.
I think it's interesting.
Which is ballsy.
That they're doing it. It is. Absolutely it is. And it's taking an editorial stance, which is something that they should all have been doing about this stuff.
Mm. And Pinterest is, it's not like Pinterest is squeaky clean on this. They've had shit in the past for pointing people at dodgy information.
Yeah.
It's just that they've actually gone, okay, enough, we're going to fix this.
Well,
I think in the same week that Google is just getting rightly again pounded for some of the paedophile stuff going on in kid videos that are on, it's awful.
You know, every time something like this crops up, you go, well, it just goes to show the scale of the problem.
Yes, there was an article that I saw. Well, Casey Newton did a thing in the newsletter, and I went back to this thing in Wired that was a while back. And this idea of freedom of speech versus freedom of reach, I think it's really interesting. And that idea that you can say what you want, but that you have absolutely no right for that to be amplified by these algorithms.
No. And there was another piece of research, it might have been referred to in that piece actually, that basically said, yeah, as soon as people get exposed to this sort of stuff, even if they are, you know, critically minded people, just repeated exposure naturally changes your opinion on something. So even if you are, you know, pro-vaccination, as everybody should be, just by process of kind of this slow drip, drip, drip of anti-vax content, you will eventually begin to, you know, regard it as just another side of science as opposed to something that's just completely harmful. So, I mean, fair play to Pinterest for taking a stand on this.
Yay, Pinterest!
So Medium is launching its own subscription publications, which, I've got a huge sense of deja vu about this. Didn't they do this a couple of years ago?
Yes, they did. I can't remember, though, before whether they just enabled other people to produce subscription publications on the Medium platform or whether they actually hired journalists. This time around, they're actually hiring journalists. They seem to be doing a little bit of a Netflix.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
They're throwing money at content because, as they explain it, they now have the subscription infrastructure in place. They're using that subscription infrastructure to pay content creators. So I guess this is just a little bit like, I don't know, priming the pump, maybe making sure there's plenty of original features and columns and essays and whatever all out there. That people will think, oh, there's really good stuff on Medium. It's worth $5 a month. Let's go.
Well, yeah, like I said in the article that we're linking to, it's launching four new publications, which are sending out to cover science and tech, business, health, and general interest, which could mean anything. And it will be comprised of original features, columns, and essays by known and unknown writers and experts. So exactly as you said, it's building out a sort of small stable of original content on there.
I'd love this to work. I love Medium. I think there's some great, great content on Medium. I don't know. That's an interesting thing. Maybe we should experiment with that.
What, you mean Media Voice is actually practicing what we preach?
Yeah, God forbid.
It was interesting that, you know, right at the start we were talking about Mark Thompson, and I was gutted because I felt like Ken Doctor had nicked our armchair CEO idea. If you were in charge of a local news title, what would you do with it? And that... maybe we could do like a series of that behind a paywall on Medium. Maybe that'd be something to try.
Ooh, or Patreon.
Ooh, give us money, give us money, give us money, give us money.
buy us a coffee. No, don't buy us a condo in Florida.
Unfortunately, even when your guests are as good as ours, transcription is still an arduous task. Thankfully, due to our partnership with Trint, we have access to an automated transcription tool that takes all the legwork out of the process. So to begin your own free trial with Trint, try saying that fast. Don't forget to follow the link in our weekly newsletter, which you can sign up to at voices.media in your interwebs browser app.
This week I spoke with Chief Executive of Digital Content Next, the trade association for everyone that's anyone in online publishing. Our conversation was always going to veer towards the duopoly and the challenges that it poses major online content producers. But I started by asking Jason about the history, aims and ambitions for Digital Content Next.
So DCN, Digital Content Next, we launched about 5 years ago. We were formerly known as the Online Publishers Association. But we are 100% exclusively focused on the digital content companies, both news and entertainment. Our simple tagline is to advance the future of trusted content. But what that should mean is doing what we can to explore, understand, provide strategy, policy, advocacy work for the content companies, 100% focused on the future and where things are going.
And the member list that you have is insane. You know, just run through some of those guys. That's quite a list.
Oh, thank you. It really is the must know brands across what was the television, newspaper, magazine world, but in the native digital companies too. But it includes everybody from the New York Times and Washington Post to Condé Nast and Disney and CBS and NPR, Atlantic Media, Vox Media, Slate. Yeah. So some of the native digitals. Yes.
Even like there's people like WebMD in there and the Weather Channel
anybody that's got a brand that's really built off of trust and providing news, information, entertainment to the end customer. I think what's important is every one of these companies has a direct relationship with both the consumers and the advertisers, and that really what we don't have in our membership, which is probably equally as important, is we don't have the ad tech companies, the vendors, the social networks, the search engines.
If someone came along, I'm not thinking of the platforms or the vendors, but if a publisher came along and wanted to join and you didn't think they met a certain criteria, would you say thanks but no thanks?
We would, and that we have that criteria spelled out, and it has happened at times. Our membership committee makes the decision, so...
What does that look like? What's the sort of rules and regulations?
I mean, one of the simplest ones that really does separate most of the wheat from the chaff, if you will, is that a majority of your resources and investment needs to go into the actual funding of the news and entertainment and the professional news and entertainment. So that alone, as soon as you're putting your own resources towards the content, normally separates most of the players out there.
So not aggregation or that, just that kind of republishing type model.
That's right.
Okay, so I don't think I'm giving away any trade secrets if I say you're a well-known critic of the duopoly. You must spend so much of your time both reading about what's going on there, but also thinking about it. What's the biggest challenges that you think Google and Facebook actually pose for your members? Why are they such a big deal?
Yeah, you labeled me a critic, and I understand that term. It's not like I wake up in the morning attempting to be critical of their businesses, but we spent probably about 3 years ago spent a good amount of time analyzing the scenario of, there was a lot of celebration across digital media that it was growing 20-25% per year, and and everything was rosy across the industry. And what we were finding is, regardless of what type of company it was, if you looked in aggregate across the companies that were actually creating the news and entertainment, they weren't growing anywhere near the clip that was being discussed. And so we started to break down the numbers, and the simple math was that a majority of the growth in the industry was going to two companies. So that's easy for everyone to understand. We use the term duopoly, and it kind of carried its own flag and became a widely discussed phenomenon. The challenge that we really were trying to point to that finally is becoming a discussion in a more material way is what makes them so dominant. and so hard to compete with. And at the end of the day, that's their, we believe that's their ability to collect data across the web, across our lives, across devices, and to micro-target advertising against it. And in a way that is so powerful that it usurps and replaces the real value of the media itself and the content or the experience. And so that's the biggest challenge I see for our members, is that unless that data is available to everyone, you can't compete on the targeting that has become what is, you know, the most critical element in digital media.
Do you also think part of that then, in terms of your role, is to get people focused back on that trusted content creation rather than just the micro-targeting? Micro-targeting is clearly a big deal, but without that trusted content, then what are we talking about?
Yeah, that's, you know, without that, then, you know, I mean, this is the interesting thing and why Google and Facebook are also such important and positive players if they're rightly controlled. You know, they've got the best engineers on the planet, and they've got more money than anyone. They have the ability to do real moonshots and move mountains to solve these issues. And at the end of the day, we believe their users want to discover higher quality. We believe that, you know, whether it's through search or through sharing with their friends. And so you're kind of in this vicious cycle where the way the guardrails of their profits work and the economics work, it's squeezing the oxygen out of the actual news and entertainment that the end consumer really wants. And that's not good for anyone. And so it's what are the, you know, how do we hold these companies accountable?
So if you were to put a label on what you're trying to achieve, it's a rebalancing in that sense?
Yeah, I think it's a good term for it. It's a proper value exchange, so that the, you know, what I would call intermediaries, the folks that are sitting in between the advertiser and the end consumer, that they are not able to continue to capture a majority of the growth in the industry and the welfare that's being created.
Do you think Amazon and Apple, I guess, are also part of that issue?
Yeah, they are in different ways. I mean, you know, Apple is because of its closed platform and you know, most acutely the way they're able to dictate the revenue shares in, that's problematic. And the speculation last week that they're rolling out their new subscription platform and taking 50% is obviously alarming. And you know, it speaks to their desire to use it as a growth vehicle for their own business because they have a dominant position. Amazon's different. You know, there's a lot of positive excitement about, you know, are they competing now? Does that make it a triopoly? I think probably no one wants a triopoly more than Google and Facebook, because it probably takes a little heat off of the two companies. But they compete in a very different way, which is, you know, linking the commerce to and bundling in advertising with the product placement, which creates a whole different set of concerns and challenges, but they're still fairly, you know, even at, if you say they're at, it's, you know, it's all speculative, but even if they're at, you know, $10 billion of advertising a year, that's still very small relative to Google and Facebook.
Yeah, definitely. So more and more people seem to be turning to the idea that government should be taking on a role in tackling these problems. I know the recent DCMS report in the UK struck a chord with you. You've got this huge thread at the top of your Twitter feed. And we'll actually stick a thread reader link into the newsletter on that, because it's a great way to sort of get the gist of it. But it's so easy to get lost in the minutiae of these kind of government investigations and reports. If I was to say, you know, can you give us a headline findings of that DCMS report? What would it be? What was the most important thing to come out of that for you?
You know, I think they properly captured it with, you know, Facebook's inability to self-regulate itself and really to obfuscate what was clearly a massive privacy issue that, you know, our FTC here in the U.S. is still evaluating. But, you know, they had 80 plus million personal data records that were, you know, harvested and sold by a company that was propped up and then ultimately used for election ads on their property. And rather than disclose that when they knew about it, which it's still a question of when they actually knew about it, they did a, what I would, you know, I think you can only consider really a massive cover up without, you know, clear information from them that proves otherwise. And so Yeah, I think probably the bigger global lesson beyond getting lost in the weeds of the details of those investigations, that committee out of the UK, the DCMS committee, did, I thought, a fabulous job of learning about the issues. And if you watch where they were nearly 2 years ago when they started the investigation to where they are now as a committee and as individuals, and I'm sure the staff, they are incredibly educated on the issues. And as much as we in America made a joke of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony to Congress and the questions that were asked, I think that DCMS committee is proof that you know, that the lawmakers can actually step in on behalf of the public they represent and get educated. And I think, you know, and we all can get educated, the folks that try to cover and follow the industry. And I think that was an important output too.
So in that sense, is Europe leading the US on this? More importantly, will the US follow?
I think that's true, Peter. We made a conscious decision probably about 4 years ago that nothing probably was going to happen in the US in terms of trying to hold these companies in check, and that there was more likely to be movement in Europe. And that included, you know, the antitrust investigations that were being opened by the EU and then GDPR and data privacy regulation. And I think that's played out in the way we expected. I think where we were wrong, and I think I'm a bit surprised, is how quickly that discussion has now moved back across the Atlantic, and how quickly especially in Washington here in the US, how quickly it's turned on Google and Facebook. So they've lost this halo that they had, in which nobody could question their motives.
Do you think, I mean, that's a great way of putting it, do you think that these kind of investigations get behind the curtain and showing people that the problem here is not so much that these guys have got great technology, the problem is that they're skewing the playing field, you know, much the way Microsoft did years and years and years ago?
I think that's absolutely right. And there's, you know, in the case of Facebook, there's legitimate questions that they haven't even answered that only I think lawmakers can demand answers on, that actually force them to show underneath the curtain in some of the decisions they made. Now, there were emails that were leaked out that DCMS got their hands on, and you see a little bit into that. But at the end of the day, if you're a Facebook or Google or any large dominant company, and you control the guardrails around your profit, if you will, you're always going to make the decisions that bring you in more money. In some ways, that's your fiduciary obligation, and somebody has to hold that in check.
Playing devil's advocate with this, do you think regulations like, you know, the EU copyright directives, articles 13 and 11, can actually work? You know, where you're making platforms responsible for copyright or taxing them for linking?
Yeah, you know, let's put aside copyright for 1 second. I think there are certain types of regulations that can work, and the biggest fear is always that they lock in, you know, they lock in the dominant players because of their ability to influence the regulation. And so you have a law in Europe with GDPR that I think is quite well written, and if properly enforced, there's still the question about, you know, the will to enforce. But if properly enforced, you know, there's a lot about what Google and Facebook are doing or how they operate that run into either GDPR violations, which they're starting to, or antitrust violations and how they manipulate it. In terms of other regulations around, you know, content censoring and making sure that harmful content's taken off platforms, that worries me a lot more. These are private platforms, and I'd, you know, much rather the government not be involved. I'd rather the platforms be forced to focus on not spreading harmful content. So don't censor that piece of content that's on Facebook just because it's false. But please eliminate the ability for it to reach millions of users. So eliminate the virality and the recommendation engines that actually fuel spreading disinformation, but please don't censor it. So that part worries me more, and there's some movement that's happened in Germany and other countries that I think, you know, we need to sit back and watch, because I don't think it's clear that that's a good role for the government. Copyright is the most probably controversial, and I think part of that is due to Google's influence and ability to try to change the narrative of what that really is. The elements of the copyright directive that's been passed, you know, mostly are in favor of publishers and have plenty of interesting ways to avoid the worries that everybody continues to pass around. So, you know, this term link tax, I think, is a complete misnomer. That's not what it is, but it was labeled that by Google. And so, you know, you see, you know, the Financial Times, which, full disclosure, is one of our members, did a great piece on, you know, and great reporting on how Google was influencing the publishers to try to win them over on copyright advocacy. And I think you just had to keep your eyes wide open. At the end of the day, Google's out to protect Google.
I think that's an interesting point that that people do forget, because they use these products so much. They forget that they're for-profit organizations, and they're driving forces to make money. And people forget that because they're so close to them.
That's right. And to be fair to, I think this is where the halo came from in DC here in the US, is they're doing things and inventing things that are quite amazing, right? Mm. So to be able to have what we have in our pocket at all times in terms of an information device, you know, versus what we had 10 years ago is quite profound. Now, does that mean that just because I can pull out a device and basically have access to anything, information I want in the world, that Google should also be able to track every single foot that I walk with that device? You know, and so who sets that proper value exchange? Yeah. And we need to make sure that the power of what they bring to the table doesn't overlook the common sense human expectations that we should have.
So back at that question of balance again.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, being a little bit cynical, government can make all the reports they want, but ultimately it's the money that's going to talk here. It's only when advertisers stop spending with Facebook or with Google that things are going to change, surely.
That's, you know, that is in the list of stakeholders that can make them change more than anybody. So Facebook's 98% advertising, Google's 90% advertising. So the platforms at the end of the day have one customer, and that will drive change. And, you know, I think your cynicism's right, if I'm describing it properly, that these advertisers are so beholden to the channels that they've developed with Facebook and Google that it's hard for them to speak out. And they're so small relative to these businesses that, you know, even if you take the largest advertiser in the world, they're very, very small. So unless they're willing to speak out publicly, which is literally just job risk for a CMO to speak out publicly against Google and Facebook, then you're not going to see that happen. I mean, we had stories in the last 48 hours here in the US around disinformation and anti-vaxxers, and the other one was around pedophilia exploration on YouTube, and a few advertisers pulled out. But, you know, if you can't get on your soapbox and say, I'm not going to invest in a platform that has pedophilia being spread, then it's really hard to imagine that anything's going to pull them out at this point.
So if you had your superpowers, if we could give you the superpowers to fix this mess, how would you fix it? How would you fix media?
You know, the superpowers allow me to change things tomorrow. I would actually eliminate any ability to use data outside of the actual product experience that you're choosing to use. And so that would mean, you know, and you're seeing this start to happen. You know, Facebook, Germany's now said Facebook can no longer use data across Instagram, WhatsApp, and the Facebook platform. That's a big deal, and it worries them greatly. You know, Google shouldn't be able to collect data across 75% of the top websites out there. If you limit the ability for that data to be able to be collected across your life and across the web, then you put a lot more power back into the actual companies that the user chooses to use. And that at the end of the day, that aligns with the user's expectations. And so the intersection of kind of data policy, which you have with GDPR, and competition law is critically important. And I would dive in hard there. And you know what? To be fair, that's starting to happen in a lot of different areas. And so I'm actually optimistic right now and seeing in the last, you know, year to 2 years, that discussion start to play out. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
So GDPR is media's superpower?
GDPR actually can be a positive for the media if properly enforced. And so giving resources for that enforcement, I think, is critically important.
Talking about positives, your summit in Orlando in January was striking for a completely female lineup, which, you know, I don't think I've ever seen before, but certainly not at the sort of level that you guys are working at. Why an all-female lineup? Why not 50-50 or a gender split of some other type? Why all-female?
You know, we just did that this year based on, you know, for 4 years I've been with the organization, we have always strived to lead with actual balance in, you know, and well beyond gender, but in the types of both individuals and companies on stage. And, you know, in a gender perspective, we've always tried to be close to 50-50. And, you know, I think we've done a good job as a team, but this year we decided to tip the scale, put our thumb on the scale just this year. And we had top female executives across every topic that we knew our members wanted to hear on. And we thought, let's do this. Let's just pick the female this year, just this year. And, you know, I think what the greatest compliment was that, you know, I think everybody at the end of the day was talking about the topics and how smart the speakers were and how much the event was as good as it's ever been, and not about the fact that it was an all-female lineup.
But definitely, you know, the fact that it's noticeable is ridiculous because there's so many all-male panels or all-male lineups that you see. The last question we always ask our guests is to recommend a piece of media that's made an impact on them recently. What would your recommendation be?
I guess it'd be a podcast, and it's really a larger story that I've been captured by. And that's, you know, Kara Swisher from Recode and Vox now does her podcast, and she did an interview with Maria Ressa out of the Philippines. I don't know if you're familiar with Maria's story, so, and she was Time Person of the Year, and we actually had her on stage at our summit, and she was arrested last week for a ridiculous trumped up charge. And now back, you know, running her newsroom in the Philippines, but, you know, very much that podcast and kind of really starting to understand this, how this intersection between the platform's power and in her case, Facebook, which is used by 97% of the Philippines as their internet, basically, how that combined with, you know, government intimidation, which is very much a concern globally and even here remarkably in the United States at this point, how that can affect people in their lives and newsrooms. And so I was captured by that podcast, and it's really driven me.
So next week, we'll see you on the other side of 2020 Publishing, a conference in London that we're all going to be at. And if you want any more information on that and maybe how you could meet up with us, you can go to 2020publishing.co.uk.
And if you want to find out what we're up to, what we're reading, what we had for tea.
How amazing I am at Tetris.
Really?
Oh, I'm incredible.
Excellent. Yeah. Follow Chris's Tetris exploits on at Media Voices Pod.
And until next week, when we're going to be back again with another fantastic guest and a whirlwind tour through all the news and views from the media world that week. Thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.